Great. Welcome to this rather special episode of the Founders Speak podcast in collaboration with Couchonomics. Joining me on the yellow table is someone I think most of you should know of. And if you don't, I would suggest you go and Google David Shom before you actually see this episode. But I want to just welcome David, and I want David to sort of introduce himself, because I guess I can't do that justice. So, David, over to you.
Well, you know, I'm the guy who invented electronic money, a digital bearer instrument, in the early 80s, because I knew how important it was that, you know, that people could protect their own privacy in the upcoming information age. And at that time, the National Security Agency said, you can't have a conference about cryptography. We're going to throw the book at you. And so as being a graduate student at Berkeley and realizing how important cryptography and electronic money would be going forward, I organized a conference on cryptography. It turned out to be a major conference. It's the basis for the International Association, the major professional association in the field now. But I risked spending the rest of my life in jail to set electronic money and cryptography free.
So he's not in jail. He works out of LA, but I guess he's most of the year traveling to different parts of the world. David just spoke at the SFF 2023, and the title of his conversation, or his speech, or his presentation, or his talk was "Better Than Money," right? And he was kind enough to share with me, if I may call it, a white paper or a paper, which provides the background to the presentation that he presented. I went through it. It was fascinating. I have to be honest with you, some parts took two or three times of reading, and that's not a function of what's written, but it's a function of my intellectual capability.
It's a little dense in parts. Yeah,
it is a little dense. And you know, this has been a crazy 4 days for most of us.
Yeah.
Right. But I think, David, let's just start with trying to summarize the presentation, which obviously only a subset of people who are here at the SFF heard.
Yeah.
And hopefully this podcast will project to, you know, anywhere between 20 to 100,000 people, right? And across the world. So what was Better Than Money all about? So what is that all about?
Well, you know, it might seem surprising that someone who invented electronic money is now against money. I'm like the only person in the world who thinks money is evil. It's a bad thing. And what you really want is the ability to keep all of your assets invested in different assets, like, you know, like Bitcoin, like gold, like Ethereum, and maybe some currencies and Apple stock,
different asset
whatever
classes.
You have. Yeah. And also even, you know, oil futures and so forth. So that, like all the exchange traded funds, there's like 1,100 of them. You know, this allows a richness of, you know, for each person has a different need for the type of portfolio, like back in the old barter days, you know, because you might have travel plans, or you have, you know, your business requires access to energy or real estate, whatever. So, you know, it's better, but poor people are forced to hold money, which is just debt, and it's inflationary, and it could vaporize. But they're forced to hold it in order to, you know, to buy food, to transact. And so they never get ahead because they can't accumulate wealth. Rich people keep, or corporations, they keep as much of their assets in investments as possible. Of course, they don't want to hold cash. So the financial system basically is forcing the poor to give the value to people who can invest it and make money off the poor. It's money is a ripoff for the poor. You know, it's the payments industry, according to McKinsey, crossed $2 trillion in revenue, in annual revenue, in, you know, during the pandemic, and then it's up to like 2.5 now or something. It's this is a tax on a $100 trillion global, you know, it's a 2% tax on the global GDP. And this is friction that's dragging the whole economy down. And, you know, the rich, you know, medium rich people are, you know, that when they do consumer transactions, they're getting a discount with their Amex cards, right? So the poor are paying for that, And, you know, poor people who need to send money back home, they're paying 6-7%, even though World Bank said, you know, guys, you got to stop this. Let's do it at 5%. And everyone said, well, okay, we'll cap it at 5%. Now they're back at, you know, to 6 or 7%. And it's so, but the real thing is, you know, it's, I as a slight epiphany that ordinary people are rationally saying, like, you know, the system's not working for me because I'm not really feeling like I'm, you know, bettering myself and I'm going to be able to do as well as my folks did, or, you know, and so I'm just going to throw in with, you know, these guys who, you know, are going to just take over everything. To heck with democracy. It's not working for me. Okay. But if you look at the last, you know, century, right, there was another kind that happened. The ugliest things that ever happened because of that kind of situation where, you know, the economy wasn't working for people. So they said, oh, we'll go. But for the people that it was working for, where there was, you know, prosperity was growing and people could feel it individually, they became real defenders of democracy. Look at the U.S., you know. So basically all we have to do is just stop forcing the poor to hold money and let them hold assets, because AI can help them invest it really well. You know, the alternative is, of course, that AI will help the really rich invest it really well, and they'll keep screwing the poor. You know, and that's just not that's not going to end well for everyone, because this, you know,
the have
tension
and have
that
nots,
we have
yeah.
underlies a lot of conflict and the shift towards centralization of power. And make no mistake, this, if we shift to centralization of power now, AI will ensure that it is irreversible. You know, finality in payments is a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. But in civilization control, it's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And we've always had the idea, well, if it doesn't work out, people won't, you know. Yeah. No, forget that. AI is already shown how it can, so even the primitive AIs, how easily they can manipulate public opinion, you know, beliefs, and even values. So you can easily be certain that if power is ceded to some, you know, centralized authority, they will use AI to make sure that they never get out of power. That's what power always does. So it's the end, you know. Thank you, Francis Fukuyama, end of history. I'm saying this will be the end of civilization. You know, well, you can talk about going to Mars and all this shit. No, that's ridiculous. We are at the precipice of ending civilization.
It's very interesting. I never thought that I'd be hosting a podcast where we'd be talking about the end of civilization using money as a concept. But I understand your way of thinking. But I'll replay my understanding in a very simple way.
Sure.
What you're suggesting is that everybody, irrespective of where they sit on the wealth curve,
yeah,
should be able to hold their monies in asset classes which allows money to be more efficient for them, and therefore it works for them.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Which is what the rich are and the large corporates are.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the second part of that discussion, and I'm sure there's several parts of this discussion, is with things like AI, you can actually all become treasurers yourself. So, you know,
yeah, it could be a great equalizer. So it could be misused just to make the rich richer, but actually it's actually capable of empowering
the poor.
But the thing is, making the poor richer will make everybody richer, because all ships will rise, and it will, you know, war and strife is not good for anyone. You know, economic collapse, you could say the rich don't care, they could benefit, but warfare and struggle is damaging to anyone. Okay. And everyone.
So here's the million, billion, trillion dollar question, right? So if you really look at the world of money and the way, you know, things are sort of playing out right now, so there is this concept of programmability of money, which we're seeing, and you know, you obviously catalyzed it by, you know, electronic money. You know, I hope you sleep well.
Yeah.
These days, right?
No, but, yeah, okay.
Right?
So, but look at eCash 2.0 with the CBDC that the Swiss National Bank and the Bank for International Settlement built. It's my invention with my co-author Thomas Moser, Swiss National Bank. It's a privacy protecting CBDC that is in effect, unconditionally secure against counterfeiting. So there's no good technical argument for not using it.
Okay. But people are, right?
In other words, don't blame me.
No.
Because I went out of my way to prove that you can't use a technical argument for making an evil use of a payment system.
I totally get it.
Okay.
But if you really look at, you know, the way money's moving, so, you know, you have public infrastructure coming around in terms of how payments are managed, because, you know, government really looks at data as now a national tool, right? And so therefore, there's a lot of public infrastructure being built around payments. It's actually being nationalized. The world is getting more global. Payments is getting more local, right?
Well, yeah. So it turns out that the eCash 2.0 that I mentioned can actually allow central banks to monitor all kinds of economic aspects, like what categories of people are buying what, you know, spending on what kinds of goods and services and so forth. So the idea that you need to surveil the population in order to get this kind of useful aggregate information is disproven by eCash 2.0. So the real government role in payments is a response, you know, central banks view their mission and their charter as protecting a public good, which is money and the nation's money. And that's something they're doing. It's a commons. And they that facilitates economic activity. But what I've now shown with this direct asset to asset transfer is that that is actually a regressive tax that's paid out to the private sector, and that if they want to promote the common good, what they should do is, you know, central banks do not want to be in the payments business. They don't even like doing what's called real-time gross settlement, you know, where they settle for commercial banks, right? They like the Fedwire and so on. That's below their pay grade.
But is that not an American view to the life? Because everywhere else in the world, you're seeing central banks actually get into payments, right?
That's kicking and screaming. CBDC has not really been wholeheartedly adopted anywhere.
Oh, no way.
Because they're not anxious to do it.
But domestic schemes, domestic rails, right? Faster payments. Well, A lot of them are actually
trying to promote the public good, but they're not. What I'm saying is, they have no inherent desire to be involved in the operational aspects of payment systems. To the contrary, they always act to get out of that because they don't benefit from that. They're supposed to be there, you know, to do the bigger things and protect the country's wealth, sovereignty, so they're not interested. It's not like they're trying. You know, there's a question: if does the public want central bank money? Are they, you know, they're regretting that they're losing access to central bank money because banknotes and coins are falling into disuse in many places? And should central banks then step in and provide access to central bank money to make up for that? But that's a secondary thing.
Okay, let's take.
I'm sorry, but
no, nothing to sorry about. In a sense, I would love to have a separate conversation.
That's a whole, you know,
yeah,
I mean, that's not really the point. The point is the world's about to melt down because people are giving up on democracy. The youth in America don't seem to be very enthusiastic about it. We've got to find a way to let people who don't have a lot of resources start to gain resources, and the way to do it is to get them out of holding money and let them hold investable assets.
So last question before we end this discussion.
Oh.
How does it actually hold true for cross-border movement of money? So the concept of better than money.
It's perfect for that.
But does that mean the whole world needs to shift?
No, this is not a boil the ocean thing like John Doerr once told me about. This is something, you know, a commercial bank, just a regular, what people consider to be a bank, could issue this to all their good customers, and they could use the app, and the customers, it would seem like it was working the real way for them, and they would benefit from it. But then other commercial banks, say in that country and other countries, could agree, make bilateral agreements, and then you would start to develop a system, could be global. You know, when you want to have foreign currencies because you plan to do travel or you need to make remittances, well, that's just one asset category. So that's what it just shows how one size fits all, like sort of a Procrustean straitjacket, you know, where you know, chop off your feet if they're too long. You know, the money is what, you know, we had barter before money.
Yep.
And that was the good thing about it, was that you had the kind of things you wanted to keep because that you felt were valuable and would be helpful to you in the future. You had your own portfolio choices with barter. Then when we went to commodity money, like gold-backed money and fiat money, that was taken away. It's one size fits all, which even the classical economists showed that's not optimal for anyone, let alone for future payments, for loans and credit. It's even the World Bank doesn't do, they do, all loans are in baskets of currency, right? Because if you want to project, you know, well, you want to have a future payment, like for supply chain, any kind of loan, it's not good to do it in a, so, you know, this is just the wrong way to organize an economy. We need to do it in a way that allows people to accumulate wealth and to be, let's say, you know, have their feet in more than one region of the world, possibly like many of us do, and to, you know, sort of fungibly and flexibly give their input to the financial system about what things they think are really valuable and so on. I leave that to people who may have some conflicting interests and so on. That's not good. So markets really benefit when you sort of crowdsource, you know, what's of interest. So it's just a huge win-win. And my sort of, you know, molding industry closing parting line would be that, you know, who knew that it was possible to do direct asset to asset transfer? But the technology is now here. And I've proven it out with eCash 2.0. It's super strong. And it took me better part of a year to figure out how to do this, but you can really do it. And so it, now that we know, because no one even thought about doing it because it didn't seem practical, but you can actually do it. And we're now at a point where AI makes it, as you say, you know, really great. And so let's do this thing and let's do it now. Let's go.
I said that was the last question. That wasn't. This is the last question. Okay. So where are you, David, in your conversations with the central banks across the world, right? And where are you seeing receptiveness? Oh, where are you seeing?
Well, I don't want you to say. Let me put it to you this way: that there are a number of you know, central banks, if you will, nation states that are very interested in this because, you know, it's a way to make friends with people all over the world and to guarantee that the militarization, weaponization of money isn't going to leave you out. Most countries around the world were not very happy when the U.S., you know, started just pushing people around. They thought, hey, maybe this could happen to us.
Yep.
That's the job of the central bank, to make sure that never happens.
Yeah, and
to
that's
them.
When there's domestic
schemes
came around.
If they institute, they are active in a system like this, it totally protects them against that kind of thing. It befriends them with the emerging economies, which is something a lot of countries want to do. And it guarantees them a kind of wealth generation going forward. I mean, this is not a charity. It's a doing well by doing good. There's a lot, you know, that's a $2 trillion just for payments. This is a replacement product for that whole market, the whole $2 trillion. So are we going to charge $2 trillion for this? Hopefully not. But that gives us a lot of headroom because I'll tell you, the computers you need to make this happen, the software we've already written, you know, a lot of it, yep. It's not fully written. I mean, come on, there's plenty of money to be made here without, and still,
there's plenty of headroom. So how are you, how do you evangelize this concept wide enough, rapidly enough, right? And then take people up the curve? Because I think there's, you know, there's three parts to it, as I said, right? So how are you doing that? Because, you know, you're obviously very, very passionate about it. You believe in it. And that's how you should be, like any good sound founder. And you've been doing this, you know, for decades, as you know, the other day when you were telling me that very interesting story, right? So how are you evangelizing this?
Well, I mean, I don't want to be, you know, it just, it so happens, and it has, you know, it took a lot of work and it has pluses and minuses, but, you know, a lot of people heard of me in the financial industry. And so I could, I have entree into a lot of, you know, whatever places I want to go. So that helps me with the evangelizing part. But I think there's a more fundamental thing, which is, like I said, there's a lot of money to be made and there's a lot of protection for nation states to be had. But interestingly, technically, the infrastructure is not inherently a centralized one. It's a decentralized one in a few dimensions, and that only improves its robustness, but also its scalability. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, there is a kind of central entity in the system. You need at least one that doesn't take custody, but it makes sure that things happen, locks things up so the other people can unlock them when they're happy. So that there, that can be in any number of instances. So even famous brands we have today in the payments industry might find themselves, you know, positioned there to do that. Commercial banks can operate it independently, as I mentioned. We can have a separate, you know, blockchain-based thing that's, you know, just operating out, globally with, you know, and so, but there can be, for each asset, there can be multiple providers. So you get a very decentralized and robust system that is very scalable. So, I mean, technically, one of the key features is, you know, there's like 1,100 exchange-traded funds just by BlackRock. So those are all different. There's 10,000 altogether. You know, it's 10% of global assets under management are in ETFs. Mm. It's a $10 trillion. It's a proven. We just use those assets. That the same legal structures. It's all great. So the central entity can auction off like a shopping mall. That's a proven business model. You know, who wants to be the dollar provider? Well, that's going to cost you. You know, there's a lot of ways to scale it, but technically, you see, if you made a system like that, it was all centralized. If any one of those asset category providers kind of failed or was sluggish or went down, the whole system would start to look bad. Yeah. So I've designed it in such a way that only these lightweight central entities, of which there can be several, so central maybe is more centralized than it is, has to be live at any given moment. So all the asset providers are offline. So when you make a payment, it's only between you and the central entity, and then it's kind of locked in. It's sure that it's going to happen. The recipient, when they say, okay, yes, I see it's all good, they unlock it and they get it. So there's no online requirement from the asset provider. So it scales to any number of asset providers, and it's very robust. So you know, from a business model point of view and a technical point of view, it's extraordinarily scalable. And because there's money to be made and, you know, and there could be competition, I think, you know, we can get various, you know, banks and countries and then the blockchain people, you know.
The whole ecosystem can get involved is the point, right?
Yeah, and yeah. Everyone can be, yeah. You know, and everybody getting in there and doing stuff without having to wait for anyone else and trying to take, you know, establish themselves, and it's not going to degrade the whole. And the client software, the user software, like we have a demo of, it's a fully written, okay, I don't want to miss it, but the interesting parts are written. You know, it doesn't have to trouble the user with where it's getting which assets. So those can be coming from various places. So some from commercial banks, some from blockchain, but it all seems like one, can seem like one nice unified system.
Great. David, last question. Not a question. Last ask. And you don't have to have an ask.
No.
Is there an ask for everybody from you? Is there an ask to every listener?
Well, you know, please take the time to go to charm.com and, you know, you'll see some of the things I've been, there's the eCash History Museum and, you know, there's some fun, interesting stuff up there. But one of the panels on the landing page that you can click through to is Better Than Money. And you can, like, I'm not sure all what will be up there when you get there, but, you know, the white paper, they're hoping there'll be like a audio, at least video, and maybe
so links to some podcasts. Familiarize yourself.
Yeah, check it out, because this is something that can you know, save the world, and we can make a lot of money doing it. So let's get going.
Well, why not then? David, I want to thank you. When are you flying back, or when are you flying out of Singapore? You're going to hang around a few days?
I'm going to take it easy. Yeah, someone was nice enough to lend me their villa, so I'll just stay for a few days, and then it was a big push to get ready to make this announcement here, and I'll just sort of chill out, and then I'm heading to Dubai for a little while.
Well, then I'll see you in Dubai as we discussed,
and,
right?
And then you know, we have COP coming up,
right?
And
so, exactly, we'll see each other outside COP, at COP. But thank you for coming in. I really appreciate it. You know, the passion is just like next level, if I may say so.
You
definitely believe in it. I think your passion will just carry you through. And you know, at least you have one person sitting here who will do his best to understand this to the extent that one can. And if I have a stupid question, which I'll have many, I'm sure I'll drop them to you either on your WhatsApp or an email.
Yeah.
But thank you for coming.
This is so great. Yeah, it's really been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, sir.
Awesome. Okay, take care now.